I'll begin. That's okay. All right, so I'm going to give two lectures on implementations of quantum information. I recognize that there's a mix of mathematicians, computer scientists, physicists, maybe others. So I'm going to try to keep it more abstract. So what you need to know from the physics to do quantum information, and what you need to know about the limitations to the physics as well. If you have any questions, just ask during the talk. Don't hold back till the end. You know, and remember, if you're shy about asking questions, it's often good to ask because other people are shy. So if you feel like asking a question, no matter how stupid it might sound, I'll treat you with respect. I'll encourage it. I'll say it's a good question. Okay, so just try to keep it lively and ask as I go. All right, so the first talk is on implementation of quantum information with light, and the second talk is on silicon. So I'll cover essentials of both those implementations, and as in the other talks today, I'm going to leave a lot out. So if there's something I'm leaving out that is a particularly important question for you, that'll be fine. This will stop, yeah. I know it's hypnotizing you to see the dancing colors. Okay, so what we'll do, we'll talk about light, quantum information with light to begin with. Is that visible, color okay, etc.? Yeah? All right. So what happens in this case is we're going to look at light, you know, just like the light we have coming out of the ceiling, and then how to put quantum information to light, how to use it, and at the end of the talk I'll turn on my computer and I'll show you a movie about quantum teleportation. And what I show you at the end of this lecture, we actually uploaded to YouTube. So if you want to watch the movie more carefully, it's on our webpage for our institute in Calgary. So it's iqis.org. And it's on the homepage. You can download from there, or you can go to YouTube and search for quantum information and see it that way. The movies on YouTube don't have a lot of explanation. In fact, they have no explanation with them. So you kind of have to hear the lecture before the movie even makes sense. Okay, so the idea is that with light, so light is really just a form of electromagnetic radiation. So this is just electromagnetic, and the way that we can think about it is as a pulse. So let's imagine a pulse of light. And often, an easy way to picture it is there's some direction of propagation. So this is the propagation direction. And here's a pulse. And the pulse moves. And we can think of this like the time axis. And so typically, we'll think of electromagnetic radiation as some sort of pulse that moves along. But the truth is a little more complicated. We live in a four-dimensional universe, to first approximation. And so in four dimensions, we have three space. We have one time. And so the way I'd like you to think of a pulse at the moment is just a ball of light. So this could be our pulse. And it's traveling along. Now here, it's so complicated here to raise and lower the screen. I've got to shut everything off and turn it on. I'm not going to raise the screen, so I'm kind of stuck to essentially three boards. So what the way to think about that pulse moving is really, we have that pulse, and it's, I'm going to use up all the chalk, I can see that. Okay, so we have that pulse moving along in some direction, and then the way that we can think about it is that there's a direction of propagation, typically written as some three-component vector k, and then we have, in three dimensions, we have an electric field in a magnetic field. And so these are transverse to the direction of motion. And in optical systems, we don't really care much about B. If you set up your detector and orient it, then you set it up so that your electric field causes oscillations. Every detector, even the retina of your eye, is essentially just a dipole antenna. So there's some electron that moves up and down or back and forth. And so that electric field of the pulse causes whatever in your eye or your photodetector or your radio, your car radio or whatever, is just oscillating by that. So this, in a sense, is the physical part of the wave for detection purposes. So along comes this pulse, which is a ball of light, and there's some sort of electric and magnetic field. Now, what's important, again, I'm only focusing on what's important for quantum information, and so what's going to be important is that if I now think only in the transverse direction, so suppose that we have magnetic and electric field, and imagine that the pulse is coming out of the board. So the pulse is coming out of the board. Then what can happen here is, you know, after some time delta t, then the magnetic field and the electric field have changed their orientation. And then over some other time delta t again, it could be in a slightly different direction. And so the behavior, so the time-dependent behavior of the EB field corresponds to polarization. So essentially we make sources, and the idea is that we want to be able to control the source so we can manipulate the electric and magnetic field to behave in some way, and we have 2 degrees of freedom. So we have 2 degrees of freedom. That comes out of Maxwell's equations. Once you start imposing various conditions, you discover, you know, if people remember dV, the physicist here, you remember that dV is zero. It forces your electric field to be transverse and locks you into 2 degrees of freedom. So we have 2 degrees of freedom, and then what we can do is we can have, there's left circular polarization and right circular polarization. And these are independent fields. That means that if you get a light pulse coming at you, it's kind of composed of 2 pulses. There's 2 polarizations built in. So if you ever wear Polaroid sunglasses, you know this trick? Put on Polaroid sunglasses, and then of course things are darker. And then if you put another pair of Polaroid sunglasses in front, rotate by 90 degrees, it makes it almost completely black. So if you wear Polaroid sunglasses, one of them will block 1 polarization. And then if you rotate the other by 90 degrees, you block virtually all the light. And now most sunglasses now aren't polarized, but if you do water skiing or fishing or some sort of water sports, polarized are often really good because the water reflects in a polarized way. So it turns out that the Polaroid sunglasses are excellent for blocking light from snow, water, if you drive a white car, it's off the hood and so on. So that's the idea. We have 2 degrees of freedom. And then what happens is, so in left circular, what we have is that the electric and magnetic field, as time goes on and the pulse is coming out of the board, the orientation of this of these vectors goes left. And the right circular, of course, they go the opposite way. Okay, so that's and then Every other type of polarization, essentially, this is a linear algebra, so essentially other polarizations are just linear combinations of left and right circular. So we can form a basis of left and right circular polarization. The electromagnetic field is a vector field, so it behaves very nicely as vectors. Now, what I want to do is to connect this with quantum information. So it turns out that it's possible to represent the polarization on a sphere. So we can represent polarization state as the point, as a point on a sphere. And here, so I'll draw a sphere again. Now, the left circular and right circular are orthogonal vectors. So we can have left over here and right over here. So all we do is we put the left and right circular as points at the extrema of some pole on the sphere. Now it turns out that, of course, the sphere, we got three dimensions to work with. So I can draw different axes here. And then remember what I said, that every linear combination of left and right circular polarization is also a polarization state. So if we take left and right together, here, this point can be, and I just write it suggestively as L plus R, the left plus right. And the opposite axis, I write this L minus R. Okay? So it's just a linear combination of L and R, but now instead of the two orthogonal polarization state being extremal points on this polar axis, they're extremal on this polar axis. And then there's another one I can write as L plus IR and L minus IR. This is known as H. This stands for horizontal polarization. And this can be vertical, V for vertical. And they're very suggestive, because if you have L plus R, then your field comes out with the electric field just steady and steady. Instead of them rotating, as we saw here, they could just be kind of flatlined coming out. And then here, this is known as, I'll just write it like that, this could be right diagonal. What? Okay, I'll lift it up. How about now? Okay, thanks for pointing it out. And then this one would be left diagonal. And the reason I wanted to do this, okay, let me just mention here. These, by the way, technically are obtained by what's called, if you do optics, these are known as Stokes parameters, and this is known as the Poincaré sphere. So if you're actually doing experiments, you would work with the Stokes parameters to figure out what the polarization state is. The important thing for quantum information is that this sphere is exactly like the sphere we use for a qubit. Okay. Now I forget, this morning did we cover the Bloch sphere for a qubit? I don't think we did. No. So let me, we had the nice explanation by David first thing in the morning. And so we know that our qubit, I think he said that a qubit is many different things. To me, a qubit, I always think of it just as one thing. The qubit is just a two-dimensional Hilbert space, which is the span of two vectors, 0 and 1. Okay? So to me, a qubit is really a two-dimensional Hilbert space. And then people will call electrons qubits and photons qubits and all that. Yeah? What? Degree of freedom? Yeah, so a degree of freedom, so the question was, what's a degree of freedom? So a degree of freedom is just some independent independent property of the system that you can adjust. So with polarization, we have, the light can have two there's two polarization degrees. We can make it left or right or whatever. So in our case, when you asked about the degree of freedom, is it left or right? Well, the answer is that we have the left and the right polarizations superposed, but it doesn't have to be those. That's a basis choice. We could use horizontal and vertical, or right diagonal and left diagonal. You see? So the state of the polarization state of light is some point on the sphere. And that can be written as a superposition of a left and right circular polarization. Okay, so is that, you happy with that? You're not unhappy. Okay, so we have our qubit is H2 is the span from 0 to 1. And then what we can do is the qubit state can be written as, let's say, cosine theta 0 plus e to the I phi sine theta 1. So that's a very general qubit state. And we can then represent this on the Bloch sphere. So this is now called a Bloch sphere. And here, this could represent my zero state. This can represent the one state. And then over here, if I take some point on the sphere, I'll just draw a polar axis. Axis. Then this point, if I take this angle and call it theta, and drop down to here, and call this angle phi, then this qubit state can be expressed as a point on the sphere just by letting theta be a polar angle and phi be an azimuthal angle. Okay? So now, here's where I hope you can see the connection between light as quantum information and abstract quantum information. What we have to do now is to connect that sphere to that sphere. So here, where did I put the brush? Chalk. I'll get some of the chalk. Oh, a nice color. Oh, white. It's my favorite color. Okay. So now, let's say, if we quantize the electromagnetic field, then what we have are photons. So this will give us photons. And the way that we do it is we begin with a vacuum state. A vacuum state, which I'm going to write as vac. It's often written as a zero, but I don't want to confuse it with the logical zero state. So that's the vacuum state. And the vacuum state is just the state with no electromagnetic energy. So if you design any experiments and think, if you don't want to be careless about what's going on in any system, the best thing to do is to start with nothing and think about how you prepared everything. So instead of even thinking about there's a laser pulse, I like to think there's nothing. And then if I turn on a laser, I have to think mathematically about how that pulse is made. Then if I'm going to use that to generate entangled photons, I think about how that's made. So we won't go into all that here, but it's often the safest thing you can do in looking at implementations to start with nothing. It's the same thing if you're doing the computer science side and you care about the quantum computer or even a regular computer. You want to think that your input is zero. So if your input is always zero and you don't pretend that you have any other input, then at least you always think about the resources and the processes going on. You never make a mistake if you always start with zeros. Physically, you always start with no energy and then think about where it comes from. So that's the state with no energy. And then what we do mathematically to get a photon is we'll represent n photons by the Dirac ket with the letter N. So that represents N photons mathematically. And the way that we get it is we introduce the ladder operator, A hat dagger, that adds one photon. So physically we haven't got into it, but mathematically, if somehow we could just go to the store and buy an A dagger off the shelf, and then we could use the A dagger, we could start with nothing and make a photon. So that's kind of what we have to do, is we somehow we have to make these A daggers and create photons out of thin air. Okay? So, and the A dagger is known as the creation operator. So this is known as the creation operator. Uh-oh, didn't do high enough. This is good exercise. All right. So now, I didn't give you the matrix elements. So the N photon state is simply A dagger to the N over root N factorial acting on the vacuum. So it has the matrix elements. The matrix elements that are given by M, A dagger, N. I'll get the whole box handy. Okay. So M, A dagger, N is equal to root N plus 1 delta M, comma, N plus 1. So just like you heard in earlier talks, there were different operators. Then, once you take an operator represented by a matrix, you just use standard linear algebra techniques. Except, notice that we have, so here's a nota bene. It's an infinite dimensional Hilbert space. So this is yuck. And I'm just putting down that warning. We won't go into it here, but there's a lot of dangerous properties that come when you do infinite dimensional Hilbert spaces. A lot of stuff you heard this morning about the mathematics, isomorphisms, finite dimensional Hilbert spaces, unitary operators, etc. You have to be very careful in an infinite dimensional space. We're going to ignore all that here, but it certainly makes life more interesting because a lot of quantum information results you have to think very carefully about again. Can't take them for granted. But that's what we're going to do. We'll work with this system. The infinite dimensions come because you could buy as many A daggers as you want, apply them, and get as high an energy as you want. So there's no upper bound to how much energy you can make in this model. Okay. And then there's an annihilation operator. A hat, which is conjugate to A hat dagger, and of course we just do complex conjugate, which is trivial here, slash transpose. So the dagger has the same meaning as in the finite dimensional case, complex conjugate transpose, again with warnings about infinite dimensions. So this is the, if we had an A, it would pull a photon out, annihilate it, and if we had an A dagger, we'd be able to create it. Now what we want to do is to create, we won't worry about the physics yet, we'll get to that soon, but let's just create a photon. Now we create a photon. What we would do is make A dagger on the vacuum would give us one photon. And by this, I don't mean the logical one. This is one photon, not the logical one. So here the notation is a little bit confusing because I'm using this for both. But that's what we do. So a photon we just create. However, I warned you before, this is the degree of freedom point, we have 2 degrees of freedom, left and right circular. So is the photon that we created left circular or right circular or some combination thereof? And so here, our A dagger is really some cosine theta A dagger left plus e to the I phi sine theta A dagger r, acting on the vacuum. And this will give us a cosine theta amplitude for the left. Maybe I'll write it like this. Cosine theta in the left, e to the I phi sine theta on the right. So, actually, no, that's stupid. I'm not going to write it like that. I'll just write it as follows. This is equal to cosine theta, one photon on the left, zero on the right, plus e to the, oh, I forgot the dagger, e to the I phi sine theta, zero on the left, one on the right. You see? So if we can create a photon and somehow change its polarization, then we can make it the photon so it's in a superposition of being left and right, and it's only got one photon. Now, do you remember what I said a qubit was? The beginning? Yep, say it.
It's a two-dimensional Hilbert space.
Exactly. It's a two-dimensional Hilbert space. Look at this. This spans a two-dimensional Hilbert space. So by the definition I started with at the beginning, we've got our qubit, right? So what happens is if we can make a photon and control its polarization space, control its polarization state, then we can make an arbitrary element of H2. So here, what we do, so if we let 0 equals 1 on the left, 0 on the right, and 1 equals 1 on the left, 0 on the left, 1 on the right, then H, then we have the span of that 0 and 1 is just the H2 that we want. So we have a qubit. That was easy. Okay, so now we're happy. We've got our qubit as a single photon that can be left or right circular polarization. And that's kind of the game that we play in any implementation. We just know that we need a two-dimensional Hilbert space, and then we try to manufacture it by finding some degree of freedom that we can change the superposition and then be able to make a two-dimensional Hilbert space. So if we can make a single photon, we've got our qubit. And so this is the fundamental unit of what did David say at the beginning? It's the famous qubit, famous, I forget what he said. He used an adjective. And so if we do that, we've got our qubit. And now we're kind of at the beginning of his lecture. We've got a physical implementation. Well, we can't stop there because nature never gives us anything that simply. Michaela Mosca was kind of warning you and saying I would cover this in my lecture, and so I'm going to warn you this is not exactly what we get. Okay. Oh, by the way, yeah, I wanted to just add here that remember the Poincaré sphere? I didn't say it before, but there's the Poincaré sphere with Stokes parameters. And this, I'm going to write down, it's isomorphic. But this is the physicist concept of isomorphic. It means whatever we want to. Not a mathematician one where you check cardinality and mapping of operations. So this is just a physicist's equivalence. So this is equivalent to the Bloch sphere. Bloch sphere with the amplitudes. So the Bloch sphere we use for a qubit is the same as the Poincaré sphere. We can go back and forth between them. And now, this would be beautiful if we could make a single photon state. At the beginning, I mentioned a laser pulse. A laser pulse makes a laser, makes an EM field, but it is not a single photon. Okay, so now I want to give you a concept. Why? So I told you, if you could buy an A dagger, you're in business. But we can't do things with A daggers. So on a deep level, I would argue that, you know, the universe is somehow equivalent to a computer. If you believe that the universe is somehow computable, then what you can do is you imagine your computer, classical or quantum, and it's going to simulate your reality. So often, since I got into quantum information, I try to think of physics as though I'm simulating it and not as though it's really there. And if I want to simulate that, and my vacuum is somehow a set of zeros, all left polarization, and I write my circuit, it affects a unitary, right? Is A dagger unitary? No. So what we need to do is we have to get to the desired state by a unitary transformation. Again, we're going to forget about the subtleties of infinite dimensional Hilbert spaces, but that's the idea. So the way that you can think of a laser operating, the laser's unitary is e to the power of alpha A dagger minus alpha star A. So you could just take my word for it. That's what we'll stick with at the moment. So if we start with nothing at the vacuum, so remember the cardinal rule I said, you start with nothing, then you don't make mistakes. So if you start with nothing and you imagine a unitary, you write down the unitary you think best fits your system, it will give you at least a starting point to figure out what you've got coming out. So what happens is the laser output, if nothing, no, I shouldn't say, if no quantum field goes in, this is i.e. the vacuum, has an output onto my next chalk. I got one left and no more lecture. Okay, has an output given by alpha is EXP, alpha A dagger minus alpha star A. Now, the best way to learn at a summer school is to solve problems. So I'm going to give you an exercise, which I'm not going to check and you don't have to do, but really this is the way you learn. So as an exercise, show that alpha equals e to the minus 1/2 n bar, I'll explain n bar, sum n equals 0 to infinity. No, I won't. I'll just write mod alpha squared. That's what it is. Mod alpha squared, alpha to the n over root n factorial n. So the laser gives you a superposition. Now, by the way, remember that's the laser, but the laser operator, of course, could be like cosine theta a hat l plus e to the I phi sine theta a hat r. So when I wrote that for the laser, the laser comes out, puts out light in some polarized state, so I'm just keeping that fairly abstract. And here's the output that you get, a superposition of numbers of photons. And that goes on to infinity. That means you've got some probability of getting the vacuum, some probability of one, some probability of two, and so on, some probability of a Googleplex of photons. So, and it's not zero, but it's ridiculous, so You can think about why, you know, is this a reasonable state or not? And I'm not going to get into it. But that's the way that we represent a laser output state. And then what happens is mod alpha squared, well, actually, what I'll do here, let's go to the next thing that David covered this morning, and that's about measurement. So I kind of told you what a laser prepares. Now let's try to understand what we measure. So in quantum mechanics, there's always this duality between preparation and measurement, and we should cover both. So there's measurements. And measurements are represented by POVM. Did we cover POVM today? No. We covered channels. So POVM, yeah, okay, it was, I know what it was. I'll explain. It stands for a positive operator valued measure. And do you remember when David talked this morning about the CPTP map, completely positive trace preserving map? And then he gave the physicist type definition, which was that you could write down some operator. I forget what he did. I always think of it's the Choi cross operator, you know, K rho, K dagger, sum over these K's. So the idea is if it's completely positive, then you can construct a set of K's so that you can write your channel in that fashion. So anyway, this is essentially, and these operators had the property that some KK dagger was identity or something like that. It's in your notes from this morning. So we want to write some sort of a measure. In this case, we're just going to cover one measure. And the measure we'll cover is photon counting. So the photon counting operator, I'll call it pi sub n is the projector onto the number state n. And this was covered a bit this morning, that you can take a projector onto number n, and that will correspond to some measurement. So if we took a state, just some arbitrary state psi, then if we apply the measurement, and here the measurement would be the set. Arg. The set of pi n's. Okay? So if I'm going to count photons, that's equivalent to thinking that I have a set of detectors. So let's say you kind of imagine that you have a detector, and instead of it telling you how many photons were in the field, it just, one detector tells you if there's three, and one detector tells you if there's four, and one tells you there's five. And if it doesn't click, it sends it to the next one. So you can imagine it like an array. Physically, you don't worry about that. But you can imagine it like an array. And so these projectors each correspond to a different outcome. So when we measure, so if we count n photons, and this will just go back to axiomatic quantum mechanics, and count n photons, our state psi maps over to n and psi, which we can write as psi n n. So a measurement just projects us into whichever state, and this mod psi n squared, which is n psi mod squared, which is equal to this, is the probability of n photons. Yeah?
I mean, at some point, the photon current thing, the operation must be positive. But is there any reason for it to be generally positive?
Oh, so you mean, why is it a positive operator valued measure? It's for completeness. So it's like David mentioned this morning, where you decompose completely positive. In a physical sense, when you write down your measurement, you want to know that every possible result is included. So that's the idea. Or are you worried about the fact that it maps densities to the positivity? Are you worried about the positivity, not the completeness?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. So the idea is that I don't know on a deep, deep level, but essentially the way I think of measurements as of channels where I purify, you know, so the idea is that when I do some sort of measurement, like in optical systems, measurements typically are very destructive. You've got nothing left. But in this sense, if we do it more formally, then we say, well, it didn't destroy the state. It just projected it down to the state, in this case, a number state. And that number state emerged with some probability. And the idea is that after I measure a state and project it, it's projected to a state. So if it's not positive, it wouldn't have the meaning of a state. Can energy be negative? Not in non-relativistic quantum mechanics. So your Hamiltonian is like your energy operator, and it's got a lower bound. So, yeah, you have a semi-infinite spectrum. So whatever the bottom of that spectrum is what we call nothing. That's why it's safe to write down the vacuum, because we have a concept of we have a concept of no energy in the system such that you can't take anything out. Okay. These are good questions. Okay, so then we have the probability of n photons given in that fashion. And so now we've got at least the idea in the optical system. So we've got the tools we need to get to something much more quantum information oriented. Just to recap, so we agreed that we start with nothing. So the rule is always start with nothing. Then we saw that we make and eliminate photons by applying our annihilation and creation operators. Then after we do that, the idea is that if you really want to deal with a state, you don't apply A's and A daggers, you apply unitaries, and your unitaries are constructed out of A's and A daggers. And then, if we want to measure, we construct a positive operator-valued measure with certain properties. In this case, we just did photon counting, apply that, and then use the ordinary rules of the measurement postulate of quantum mechanics to figure out what the resultant state is and the probability. Okay, so that's, you now know quantum optics. Okay, now what we want to do is to get back to quantum information. And so the bad news is we never have a photon. If we had, we never do. But in this case, if we just do it by just, you know, driving a system in some way, and it's always a unitary, we can't make a photon. If we could, we would have our qubit. So a lot of the subtleties is trying to connect what nature gives us with what we want in the ideal world. And so with the laser output, what I'd like you to do, I'm going to give you another exercise. Okay, you thought you were going to have fun tonight, but it's not going to happen. Okay, the exercise is to show that the probability of n photons equals e to the minus n bar to the n, over n factorial for the laser output, where mod alpha squared equals n bar. And this exercise will be very useful when Norbert Lückenhaus talks about the quantum key distribution, because in that case he's going to talk about decoy states. And so just to give you a heads up, when he gets to the quantum key distribution, the problem is that in quantum cryptography, if you want your qubits to be single photons, they aren't. And every time you get multiple events, so I want to send you a photon, but I accidentally send you two, it does what they call tagging. So the eavesdropper has ways to kind of break in and suck information out. So he'll be assuming you know this. I've talked about it. So he'll assume some knowledge on your part. Okay. So that's this. And then this one is known as the Poisson distribution. And this is the same distribution that's supposed to apply. You know when you go shopping and there's always people in front of you? And then as soon as you leave, there's nobody there? So it's that distribution that gets you. And it's the same with the laser. So if you really want to, you want to have few photons, you have to have very few, because when you start getting some, they all tend to want to cluster together. It's a bosonic attraction. Okay, so now I want to get to something good. Okay, so you know that. We know about detection. Now, I told you about quantum information for polarization, but in fact we have lots of ways we could put quantum information into light. So I'm just going to give you some examples. very briefly, but it will show you. I don't want you to go away from this lecture thinking that all quantum information is in polarization. So ways to encode quantum information. Do you remember the rule? How do you make a qubit? You need a two-dimensional Hilbert space. So we get it with polarization, but if we want to encode quantum information into light, we really just want to make H2s. Okay? If we make our H2, then we've got a qubit. So let me give you an example. Well, first I gave you polarization. That's done. Now, the next one we'll do is path. And this is known as dual rail. And this is used, by the way, in the KLM scheme. And this stands for CNIL. And for all you Waterlooville-ians here, this one stands for Laflamme. And this stands for Milburn. So there's a famous scheme called the KLM scheme, which has essentially path encoding, and I'll explain it. And then we have, I'll cover the single rail briefly, and time bin. And time bin I'm going to cover because time bin is the favorite encoding for long distance quantum communication. So we'll cover those four cases. There are more that we could cover, but we won't. But there's lots of choices. That's one reason optical implementations are so popular, is because there's so many ways we can encode and transfer, and then we could say, what if our fiber is not polarization preserving? And what if, what if we get, I don't know, other kinds of noise? Like we can look at the noise, and it's very easy to switch one qubit to another. So let's do the path. And the path, we'll now consider the following. Let's consider a pulse that could come in here, a pulse that could come in here, and this is what we're going to call a beam splitter. And a beam splitter is a half-silvered mirror. So if you ever watch police dramas like Law and Order, they always have somebody in a room, you know, and they're questioning them and asking all kinds of questions. And these people being questioned, it never seems to occur to them that somebody's standing on the other side of the mirror watching them. You know, they're always surprised by that. So that's the idea. You put a half-silvered mirror or partially silvered mirror, and then that way when you look, you just see your reflection. If the light were balanced, you'd see half of yourself, half what's on the other side. So that's what a beam splitter does. And then out comes the light. And here, I'm going to label this by A, label this by B. This is A prime, this is B prime. So it's different from what we did before because we have two different paths. Okay? So before it was a single pulse, now we have a pulse here, whatever we want. Then if we do mathematically figure out the output, so for the physicists, you do this in like second year physics, it's Fresnel coefficients. So you just do your standard second year electromagnetic calculations. And then what you find is that if you wrote A prime and B prime, this is the output, and you use your Fresnel coefficients that you use to derive Snell's law, etc., then what you get is cosine theta e to the I phi sine theta, I make it minus I phi. This is negative e to the I phi sine theta cosine theta times A B. And this, so what this tells us is that a beam splitter mixes together the input, this is the input, to the output. So here, we need a two-dimensional Hilbert space. So here, we could have a photon A dagger on the vacuum is a photon in A, and B dagger of the vacuum. Actually, I'll write it like this. 1A, 0B. 0A, 1B. Okay, and this tells us this is going to go to our H2. So now we got a Hilbert space, two-dimensional Hilbert space. We have a photon that is created that either goes here, or superposition thereof, and by playing with how much silver we put on our mirror, we can make the photon come out in some superposition, and so we're able to make any state we want from any state we want. Okay? So, and we'll assume they're the same polarization. But we now have a way, another way of making a qubit. Instead of dealing with the polarization on this one, we have these two. And so as I mentioned before, that kind of qubit is the basis of the Kanilla-Flam-Milburn scheme. And I don't think I have time to go into the other realizations. The time bin, a single rail is really just superposition of the vacuum and a dagger of the vacuum. So this one is a way of, if you can take nothing and superpose it with one photon and play with that, you can do it. There's a technique, if anybody wants to ask me later, known as quantum scissors, that allows you to make the general states and then you kind of snip off. You truncate your Hilbert space, and it's possible to do it in optical experiments. So these are energy superpositions. So this is polarization superpositions, path superpositions, energy superpositions, and time bin is just spanned by early and late. And so the idea here is that you want your pulse to be in a superposition of two arrival times. And as I mentioned, this one's important in long-distance quantum communication. Okay, so we have that. Now, but we don't have entanglement, and entanglement is one of the things we love in quantum information, so we have to make entangled states. And I haven't told you how to make a single photon state, so we'll do it at once. We'll do both together. Okay, so next. Okay, next we want to make, we want to create photon pairs. Why do we want to create them? Reasons. One, if we measure one of the pair, then we project the other to a dagger of zero. So it's kind of strange. If we can make two, then we measure one, and then we know we got the other because they're correlated. So that's one reason. This is known in the literature as the heralded photon. So if we make two and then measure one, that's a herald. Like in the old days, somebody would run along the streets and shout the news from the king. So that's the herald. And number two is we want to be able to make entanglement. So we need two qubits. One photon, if we have one qubit, we don't have entanglement. So we want to be able to make two. Okay, so I'm going to have to, I'll give that and then I'll show you teleportation. Yep. All right. So just to tell you, the way we make two, we use parametric down conversion. I'll show you in a moment a crystal that does that. But parametric down conversion, all you need to know right now mathematically is that we just want the unitary. So the unitary is given by chi A dagger B dagger plus AB. So this creates, remember that's a creation operator. So we create an A photon, we create a B photon. So this creates a pair. And that if we do that, we apply it, we get X chi A dagger B dagger plus AB acting on the vacuum, and we expand that exponential to low order, what we'll get is it's equal to the vacuum plus chi A dagger B dagger on the vacuum, which is a photon in A and a photon in B. We don't need that term because it annihilates the vacuum, so there's no contribution, plus order chi squared. So if we do parametric down conversion, and remember we always start with nothing, so if we act on nothing, we'll get mostly nothing superposed with a pair of photons, superposed with other stuff. So, and then if we measure exactly one B photon, onto, let's say, 1B. 1B, that will yield 1A. So now we have our single photon, and we're happy. So that's what we want to do. And then, finally, if we make if we could make X of chi AL dagger AL dagger BL dagger plus AL BL plus AR dagger BR dagger plus AR BR, then this term will give us the vacuum plus chi, and then we'll get here 1 in L, 0 in R, 1 in L, 0 R, or 1 in L, maybe I'll write like this, 1 in LA, no, AL, this will be AR, 1 in BL, 1 in BR, plus 0 AL, 1 AR, 0 BL, 0 BR, plus order chi squared. We always have to keep the order, because that order term is what tells us the difference between the ideal quantum information and the physics going on. So over here, this is our entangled state. You remember before that with the A mode, we made a qubit, superposition of this and this. That's a superposition. And so this is really our state, 1, 0, 1, 0, 0, 1, 0, 1. And that's our state, 0, 0, plus 1, 1. So this is a Bell state. So if we can make that system, yeah. Different paths. So, you know, one goes, A goes that way, B goes that way. And each one carries a polarization. And now I'll show you how it works. Okay, so if we can do that, we've made our entangled photons. Now, I don't think we've covered quantum teleportation. So I'm going to kind of zip through, but I'll show you the basic ideas. Okay, so here, first of all, these are the crystals. So we want to be able to make this operation here. And these are the kinds of crystals. So you could buy those if you want. The BBO stands for beta barium borate. And this crystal, if you send light through, it will come out according to that operation. But historically, back in 1995 in Innsbruck, Paul Quiat, when he was a student, he had the brilliant idea, which sounds very simple now, of putting two back-to-back. One oriented one way, one oriented the other. And if you do that, and they're thin enough compared to the optical wavelength, then you don't know if you're generating a pair of right circular or a pair of left circular. So if they're back-to-back to each other, you make that operation. So one of these will do this for left or right. Two back-to-back will do this. And then what you get coming out, this is false color, and this is the output image from the two back-to-back. And let me explain it. This is, by the way, Physics World. That's the magazine for British physicists. And they picked the 10 iconic images of the 20th century. So they had to pick 10 pictures from all of physics and astronomy and say these represent 20th century advances. And this picture from doing this is one of the top 10 that Physics World picked. And so here, what you see is just these rings correspond to different wavelengths of light. But importantly, there's some point here where you could call this A and this B. And if you detect photons here and here, they'll be in entangled states. So your question, you know, how do you detect, where do they go? The answer is they come out, and this could be called the A point and the B point, and those are these things, and it's there's an entanglement between left and right photons. So this is the way, this is the standard way of making these things. The crystals are a lot better. You don't have to put two back to back. They do fancy cutting. We don't need the details, but that's the idea. So that's our entangled state generator. And now I'll just show you roughly how the quantum teleportation experiment is done. So this is the picture that was used by the team in Innsbruck back in 98 to show how they did teleportation. And so there are different claims of teleportation. This is a good one. So over here, this is the experimental version. They send some pulse, they get the entangled photons. So that's this pair over here. Then in teleportation, what's going to happen is, so let me think about this. There's Alice, and she's going to make a single photon. In their case, she makes a heralded photon that we talked about. So there's actually a pair. She measures one, then she knows she's got the other. That moves along. Then she uses something like a beam splitter for polarization to change the qubit state. Here they only did 45 degrees in this case. And then that photon mixes with her share of the entangled photon. There's a beam splitter, and then she gets a result. In principle, there are two qubits, so there's two times two results. So there's four possible results, two bits. So then she phones Bob up, and she says, hey, Bob, I got whatever result. There's only two bits. So she'll tell him the two bits, and then Bob will get his two bits, and then he's going to detect. In fact, the experiment cheated because whereas there's four possible outcomes, the experiment only used the outcome where Alice does nothing. So in those days, the electronics was too slow. They couldn't communicate. So that would just send it over to Bob. So Alice essentially told Bob nothing, and he did nothing. So that was the way that teleportation worked. But that's the idea that we want to go through. So let me show you now a movie that we made to convey. Uh-oh. Where is it? Yeah, just click down. Okay, so I'll take you through this movie. So here, remember I told you about that crystal that generates this transformation. So this is the beta barium borate crystal, and the pattern you see is actually true to the group symmetry of the crystalline structure. And then you can see we're going to rotate. Now we have two back-to-back, so that's the old-fashioned way of doing it. So we take one, and we rotate it 90 degrees to the other. So the light will come through, and that will affect that unitary. Here's a photon. So if you've never seen a photon, that's what it looks like. And then let me just explain. So we just kind of, you know, we worked with artists on it, and it's a lot of fun, because the artists always get the physics wrong. But in fact, they're kind of right on a deep level, because the idea is, is to get the concept across in the way that you appreciate aesthetically. So we showed them Bloch spheres and things like that. So there's the Bloch sphere. This oscillation represents the polarization state. So you see an electric field oscillating back and forth. As I mentioned at the beginning, you can get it from our homepage, and it's also on YouTube. So you can find it. So there's the photon traveling along. And now we send in a stream of photons. We want to make these entangled. So the photons enter the crystal, and then they have some probability of turning into a pair of photons in the first crystal. There's a pair, and blue represents they're both left circular. Or the conversion may take place in the second crystal. Can you see? Is it too bright? Can you have the lights off?
No.
No? Okay. So it converted in the second one, and it's right circular polarization. And then if we don't know which one it came from, we get this weird state with an umbilical cord connecting them. And so that's our entangled pair. So along come these entangled photons. And this is the resource for two purposes. These entangled pairs are going to be, if we detect this one, we know we have that one. That's the heralded photon. Or this entangled pair can be used by Alice and Bob for teleportation. So it serves both purposes. Much better to make them all at once. Okay, so those are our entangled pairs. One is for teleportation, the other is for heralding. Now, I'll show you a theoretician's version of an experiment. Let me just... Oops. Oh, I didn't want that to happen. Darn. Okay, so just to give you an idea, this represents a laser. A lot of things we did, we just pulled off catalogs, online catalogs, and then kind of drew them to look a bit better. These are going to be mirrors. You'll see how they work. These are the back-to-back crystals. This is a detector. Remember, its job is to project onto N. There's another detector. And so what's going to happen is the laser is going to put out a pulse, and then it's going to convert in the forward direction to an entangled pair that Alice and Bob will use for teleportation. That's their resource. And the laser pulse will be reflected back and produce an entangled pair here. One will bounce off a mirror and get detected. That's the heralding. Remember I told you about that projection. And then, so the other photon will then be the one to be teleported. And this is the polarizer rotator. So the pair that come backwards is going to be heralded. That photon is going to be rotated to some arbitrary qubit state, and then they're going to teleport. And so here, we'll come in. Then we'll see a pulse generated, travels along to the beta, barium, borate back-to-back crystals. And the first one we'll see, it could generate blue. Remember that was, red, left circular. Or it could be blue, which is right circular. And out come our umbilical cord connected pair of photons. And there's another pair that come out here. These are the resource for teleportation. This is going to be the one that's projected to prepare that photon. So along they come. This one's projected. So the cord breaks, bang. And that one's been rotated to a polarization state that neither Alice nor Bob know. One of the rules of teleportation is they have to be ignorant. And so here they do a good job of that. Now they mix them at a beam splitter, as I explained, and now you get some tripartite entangled state, and Alice then detects. And I'm going to pause. So Alice did her detection at two detectors. And the two detectors are essentially saying, did we get left and left photon? Did we get left and right? Did we get right and left? Did we get right and right? That's two bits of information. And then Alice is going to broadcast the information. They don't have a telephone, but they have radio. So here's our radio antenna. And so Bob is going to receive which of the two bits possibilities there are. And then he's going to adjust his polarizer rotator according to that result and reproduce the photon. So along comes the other photon in that entangled pair, goes along, and then Bob got his information. He rotated that polarizer, and out comes the photon in the same state as the original photon, and Alice and Bob have no idea what's going on. I mean, they don't know what the state is because the teleportation's done obliviously. Oh, shut that stuff off. Okay, so... All right, so I ran out of time easily on that. And so I'll just summarize by saying, so I think you got an idea. I went through all the mathematics fairly carefully, but at a basic level, so you got the idea of how we make photons, what they do, and so on. And I think that movie captures a lot of you know, like it gives you the teleportation. There's also a quantum key distribution segment on there I didn't show you. It shows how the photons are used for the BB84 protocol and so on. Okay, and I think, David, there's no break, is there? Okay, so I just kind of go into the next one. No, I'll keep going. Pardon me?
You can take a little break and plow through.
No, because I'm going to change topics, so I think people will get revitalized. Okay, so any questions on this? Because I'm going to now talk about silicon. Yeah. Okay, so you're asking... well, okay, so it's a good question. So what he's asking is, you know, I said two rules. I said you always start with nothing, and then you think of a unitary to make what you want. And so he's saying I broke the rule, because in the rule, initially there was a laser that sent a pulse to the crystals. So let me put it in quantum information language. With a quantum computer, we talk about the quantum information processing, but we kind of ignore all the classical instructions, right? So, you know, if I'm doing quantum error correction, I measure something, I do something, I tend to ignore even talking about that. So in this case, what we're doing is that laser pulse at the beginning is considered to be a classical field. And the classical field is used to provide the energy to create the photon pairs. Now, of course, on a fundamental level, how can that be? You know, either the field is quantum or classical. And then there's a complicated answer I don't want to go into now.
If I just take this operator, act on the...
Which one? This one?
Yeah, this one. I act on the equivalent state dimension, and we get a whole mess.
No, but I'm acting on a vacuum. That's acting on the vacuum state. But you're wondering, if the laser pulse goes in, how can I call it a vacuum, right?
Yeah.
Okay, so the answer is the A and the B modes are in a vacuum state. The laser pulse is in the third mode. Let's call it C. But then what happens is, so the laser photon is converted to a pair, but in an argument that I can go through with you later if you want, but I don't want to spend, it'll take a long time to go through. It's a very good question, is essentially it's built in chi. So what happens is chi is proportional to various things. It's proportional to the intensity of the laser. It's proportional to the length of the crystal. So that laser pulse is really there so that we get energy to create pairs of photons from the vacuum. But it's in a different mode. Correct. Okay. Yes, you do. And I can show you that later. Okay, so right now, if anybody wants to meet with me later, I'm happy to go through it. But I'm sure I can give you the full explanation. But for the moment, for most people here, just if you don't want to hear a lot about it, you can just think of chi, that the laser is a classical field, and that chi builds in the classical field driving term. And for you, I'm happy to go into technical. Yep? Sorry, let me stop you at the moment, because that's not exactly what I said. What I said is it creates a pair, but the pair is created in the same crystal. You just don't know which crystal it was created in.
Okay.
Does that stop your question, or is it still there?
I don't know. I thought about the vocal. If there is a vocal, we can distinguish it.
Absolutely.
And then you don't have just preposition, so you don't have to double.
Right.
So
no, you're right on all counts. If they were in different crystals, and then you had the ability to discriminate which one produced it, even in principle, getting information about where they're created would destroy the whole thing. And that's why I said they even have to be optically thin. So if they're thinner than, say, the wavelength, then there's no way to even learn which one they came from. But in practice, there can always be. So, for example, if you do quantum key distribution and use this approach to generate photons, you always have to watch these things, because... you know, if information does leak out and you believe in an omnipotent Eve, then, you know, it's dangerous. So you're asking good questions.
Yeah, okay.
Any more questions? Shall I go to the silicon then? We got 40. I won't run over on that one. So we got 45 minutes. Okay, this one is more computer based. What? So let me. I'm gonna show you in pictures. So for this one, I wanna use some pictures. I'll get into some more technical stuff later, but I don't think two lectures with all the mathematics is too heavy. So this one I want to do more pictorially. And so here I'm going to give you a bit of the history, and so you'll know what the silicon quantum computer is about, what the approach is, and so on. And for this, so in the early days of quantum computing, there were three very important proposals. There was the liquid nuclear magnetic resonance work, the ion trap, and the quantum dot quantum computer. And of the three, the idea that we could use quantum dots in order to be able to make a quantum computer was quite important. In fact, you know, if you look at, let's say you start thinking not at, like, let's look at the money side of quantum information. And so the idea that quantum computing could work in solid state systems became a big deal because there's a huge investment in solid state for regular computing, computer chips, and the idea that somehow we could do quantum computing on chips, hybridize and leverage off a trillion-dollar industry became very important. And historically, the first proposal for a solid-state quantum computer was by Daniel Loss and David DiVincenzo, same DiVincenzo who's got the DiVincenzo criteria. And they wrote a paper, FISREVE, and they proposed quantum dots. And so without going into all the technical details, a quantum dot is just some semiconductor material that is somehow made so small that it's essentially a particle in a box, or sometimes called an artificial atom. So you want to make these quantum dots so they're some semiconductor that's different from the surrounding material, very tiny, and plant in it one extra electron. And the extra electron, in this case, the spin of the extra electron is the qubit. So an electron you can think of as spin up or spin down, or superpositions thereof. So the electron spin is analogous to the photon polarization. And so the qubit here is a single extra electron trapped inside of a quantum dot. It's like the quantum mechanics particle in a well type problem. And the arrow is the orientation. And the orientation, of course, can be anywhere on the Bloch sphere. So an extra electron in a quantum dot is the qubit. And the idea they had, this is a two-qubit system, so they want to be able to take an electron and manipulate its spin and have another electron and manipulate its spin and also be able to entangle the two together, which is a bit of a challenge. And actually, on a technical level, what's turned out very hard is measuring these. So doing single electron spin measurements is hard. With photons, we kind of have it easy, relatively. These systems, that's one of the hardest parts. By the way, the picture here looks like somebody with a shaky hand drew it. I don't know which of them drew it, but this is straight out of their FISREVE paper. So I always think that's funny because if I send a paper and, you know, like, I would never get a paper published if I drew like that. But this paper was so good that they even got a bad picture published. So it tells you it's a great paper. Okay, so that's the idea. And then over here, this just depicts their scheme about how they would lay out rails of qubits. So this is the register, and I'll explain what these mean. So the quantum dot is simply a confined region that can hold one extra electron, and the spin of the electron corresponds to the qubit. And then there's lots of things ignored, like higher energy states and so on. And then what happens is, so in the optical system, I told you about the electric field being all important. We don't care much about magnetic field. In these systems with electron spin, we don't care about electric field, we care about the magnetic field. So somehow, we want to use the magnetic field, and so the electron spin will precess in a magnetic field. So by varying magnetic field, you're able to vary the qubit state. And so there's two kinds of gates here, T gates and J gates. And the T gate is controlled by some other quantum dot in their proposal. The idea is to have paramagnetic or ferromagnetic dot that will locally control magnetic field and be able to turn on and off a precession. So whereas in the photon case we use beam splitters or polarizer rotators, here it's local magnetic fields that would control the electron spin and change it. Then, so that will do a single qubit rotation, and the entangling is done by a J-gate, and the J-gate, here's the Hamiltonian for it, is, now this is more subtle, and I'm going to get into this because it's something anybody who's interested in physics really, I think you want to know this. And so the idea of the electric field is that it distorts the electron cloud. So you know that if you solve the particle in a well, and the well is not infinitely high, your wave function has a shape. If you could vary the shape of the well, you would vary the shape of the wave function. It turns out that if you can vary the shape by applying an electric field, you can bend these wave functions so they get closer together. Now, between them, there's still a barrier, but an electron can quantum tunnel. So think of it like this. Imagine the electron here and the electron here are each trying to tunnel into the other, and they bump their heads. And the bumping of the heads is really just Coulomb repulsion. So they kind of bump their heads, and that will cause some sort of a relative shift in the phase of the wave function, and other terms. And so that crashing into each other that's taking place, instead of tunneling through, is a mediated interaction that corresponds to this term. So by turning on and off this J gate, it's time dependent, then each qubit has Pauli operators, X, Y, and Z, and the bumping of heads is giving an X cross X plus Y cross Y plus Z cross Z Hamiltonian. This Hamiltonian, if you turn J on for just the right length of time, can give you a swap operation. You can swap the two, and if you turn it on for half the time, you get a root swap. So a root swap, if you have two particles, a swap is like that. A root swap, it's in a superposition of not swapping and swapping. That's halfway. So that's what the root swap is. There's a theorem that if you have, I won't go into that. Okay. If you have root swap and single qubit rotations, then you have a universal set of gates and you could do quantum computing. So this captures that whole loss to Vicenzo scheme. And this scheme, which never worked or hasn't worked yet, but it inspired a lot of work that came along to try to do quantum computing with quantum dots. Now, the next step in history, about a year later, is a famous paper by Bruce Kane, who was at the University of New South Wales in Australia at the time. He knew the loss to Vicenzo scheme. He also was aware that quantum dots don't behave as nicely as loss to Vicenzo would want. And what he did, he knew the history of phosphorus and silicon work from the 1950s. So he thought, what if we took the phosphorus in silicon, and I'll explain what that is, used phosphorus deposited to silicon as the quantum dots, and then, remember in the loss to Vicenzo scheme, the magnetic field was local. He said, and it turns out it's very hard to localize magnetic fields. So instead of making the magnetic field local, make the magnetic field global, so the electrons are always precessing, and use gates to, again, control the shape of wave functions. So the electrical control is local, but the magnetic field is not. And so over here, this is represents the system he had. And so down here is a silicon substrate. I don't know, I shouldn't have the arrows up to here. The phosphoruses are deposited into the silicon. This is a barrier, is just an oxidation layer, or some sort of passivation. And the quantum computing, it's not here, I'm sorry. The phosphoruses are inside. And so there's a phosphorus and a phosphorus. And the phosphorus has an electron. But phosphorus is called a donor inside of a semiconductor. So each phosphorus has one excess electron. And that, so in a way, the phosphorus is like a quantum dot. But it's a very beautiful quantum dot because every phosphorus is the same as every other phosphorus. You know, quantum dots are artificial atoms. It's much better to work with natural atoms. So there's a phosphorus and a phosphorus, each with an extra electron, and then the idea is the same as loss to Vicenzo, control the electron-electron collision and control the state of the single electron spin with a global magnetic field and local electric field. And then over here, these are just metal gates that are put on top of the system, And whereas Los De Vicenzo had T gates and J gates, Cain had A gates and J gates. And it's just the slight different language helps you remember that they do different functions. And so these are electric fields. So the J gate still controls the electron-electron collision term, but the A gate is an electric field control, not a magnetic field control, and its purpose is to change the overlap of the electron wave function with the nucleus. And I'll show you more on this. That's the idea. So there are a few clever things in Cain's proposal, but the most clever, kind of the revolutionary concept, is just use a global magnetic field, and that was inspired by nuclear magnetic resonance-based quantum computing, which that's one of the big areas in Waterloo. Ray Laflamme, Jonathan, back there and so on. Yeah? How do you perform single qubit? You mean without local magnetic field? Yeah, I'm going to get to it. How do you know the spin doesn't entangle? You don't, but you don't want it. So that becomes a source of errors, and then your quantum error correction has to build it in. So
I guess the entangles, because I mean you control the partial zero frequency to make the interaction between them. So it seems that they should entangle.
Yeah, but is it okay? So we don't want it because
We're
not using it. And so then the thing is, if it can be kept small, then we know that any decoherence can be written as generated by products of Pauli's, and then we correct.
So it's small enough
that... Well, in theory it's small, and in practice it's not done. So I don't want to tell you that they haven't yet got the qubit, so, you know, but it could be a problem. Okay, so what I'm going to do is to show you a movie that we made. And so what happened was, I had a lot of fun with this one. It turns out that, you know, so the solid-state quantum computer is perhaps the most exciting proposal to the outside world. Okay, so to us scientists, we do it for fun. But the outside world actually wants things to be built. And so one of the problems has been there's been a huge investment and, of course, promises made about the quantum computer. And it's going to take time. And so... what I did was I had a conversation with people in the United States about this in Laboratory for Physical Sciences on the best way to communicate what the quantum computer, what stage the silicon-based quantum computer was at and what needs to be done and what the problems are. And so they agreed. I said, you know, to cut a long story short, I said, give me $50,000. And they said yes, and I made the movie with some colleagues at Waterloo and in Australia, the University of Melbourne. And we made a movie. What I'm going to show you is not my proposal. My job was simply to get the scientists and the artists to talk and be able to converge on a movie for only $50,000 of animation. So that's the idea. And then I'll show you the concept, the current concept of how to make a silicon-based quantum computer. And it's actually very interesting going through because you'll learn a lot about the important aspects that are inherent in any quantum information processing device. So there's lessons beyond this to the general system, but also it'll help you understand the silicon-based scheme. So what we'll do is, and I'll at this point I'll stop the PowerPoint and come back to it later, but what we have is we're going to have the phosphorus. We're going to try to show things in a realistic way. I wish I could shut off these lights somehow, but yeah, I know there's a set. It's only 2 bits. Let's... okay, that's better. So what we'll do is we'll go in, you'll see this entity, this is a phosphorus atom. And just to mention, the phosphorus atom, there's the nucleus. The donor electron has a huge radius. It's 2 nanometers. Back here, you can see all these yellow dots. That's the silicon crystalline background structure. And the electron cloud has a radius that goes about 5 lattice spacings. So if we put 2 phosphoruses about 10 lattice spacings apart, there's quite a significant collision rate. So we can actually put them much further apart. This kind of represents the way that you calculate these wave clouds. And I just wanted to mention something. So for people doing physics, you know, one of the early problems we do is we solve the wave function for a hydrogen atom. And when you solve the wave function for a hydrogen atom, you get your s orbitals, p orbitals, d orbitals, and so on. But when you solve a hydrogen-like Schrödinger equation inside of a crystal lattice where the radius is large, then you get a dielectric modulation. So the permittivity modulates. And that means that instead of getting like an s wave function that's spherical, you wind up getting interference fringes. And this is really interesting. What we're going to try to do is use electric fields to control how much electron function overlaps with the nucleus, but these interference fringes are probably a major decoherence. I don't know if that's what you're referring to with the spatial location. This is what I was imagining you're thinking of. And so what happens is even jitters here will change the overlap. And the overlap is, again, I'm talking a lot of physics, hyperfine splitting, but we're going to see what happens. It turns out once we were making the movie and starting to watch these things in our animated universe, we started to get a sense of how critical these were. Okay, so I'll stop that, and I'll play the movie, and I'm going to play it twice. Once, just to go through what's going on, then we'll go through the rest of these PowerPoint slides, and then we'll play the movie again, and the second time you'll be experts. Okay, so you'll know what's going on. First time, don't get disheartened. Make sure the sound's off. So I won't pause it, I'm just going to take you through. Again, there was an audience for this that's supposed to hand over money, so we have to start with a problem, and the idea is to solve a 2048-bit number, and the classical computer does it in the age of the universe, and the quantum computer in minutes. Turns out we calculated it was a year's worth of minutes, so the truth is slightly stretched. There we are. We've got our computer. We dive in. There's the quantum chip. Dive into the quantum chip, and over here, this is the quantum register. It's on the edges of tiles. Each tile is loaded with electronic circuitry that has to cool. Here, each of those blue dots is a phosphorus atom with a donor electron, and that electron wave function, you can see the fringes, has a Bloch sphere that represents the spin state. So the electron spin state is the qubit. There's a global magnetic field, so you can see the precession of the qubit state. It's precessing around the Bloch sphere, and then turns out that we don't like that precession. It looks messy. So you go mathematically to what's called a rotating frame, and so we just made a frame and rotated it, kind of cheesy. And then you see the fringes as it rotates, and then what we do is we get the electron spin now precessing nicely. But notice the flash of light now and again. Turns out that even that precession is a problem. We want this to be an identity operation. So all controls are kind of stroboscopic, that we only do quantum operations that have meaning when it gets to the very top. Okay, now we've got to get the precession off the Bloch sphere. This is the A gate you were asking about. So the A gate controls the shape of the electron function. That distortion, by the way, is accurate with what they want to do. And the control here changes the hyperfine splitting, and that's what controls the precession that you see around here. Oh, I have to pause. I can't resist this. So here, you get the electron precession. Now this is our two moons, because some people here care about quantum reference frames. So I just want to mention briefly. So first of all, every operation has to be synchronized so that measurements are only done when all background qubits are up here. But what's going on in the system is that you have many qubits, and they're all precessing that global magnetic field. Lost to Vicenza was local, but here it's global. And so this extra moon is the reference frame of all other qubits that are also precessing. So it's not enough. If we want to do a Hadamard transformation and take the state from there to there, it's not enough to do that. All background qubits have to go right back to that state, the North Pole. So there's a reference frame issue that comes up in this system. And so here, you'll see that there's a control. That's done a Hadamard, but that's not in the right place. So the control of the wave function is done, so the precession will take the electron there when those were all at the North Pole. So there's a reference frame issue. This is a two-qubit gate. It's a root-root swap. Lost to Vicenza get a root swap, but you can't do that. Here you got to do root-root swap. So this is a single-qubit operation, And then over here is the root-root swap, controlled by that gate. That's the J. A gate controls just this qubit. It takes 8 operations to do a C-naught. You heard about C-naughts from David. So the C-naught in this scheme takes 8 operations. Single qubit operations take about 10 nanoseconds. The root-root swap is a tenth of a nanosecond, so it's tough. There's going to be 2 orders of magnitude difference. Here, I won't explain that at the moment, but this is the readout phase. The electron is tunneled over to here, and now it's going to go past a single electron transistor, tunnel into a nanoshottky reservoir, only if it spin up, but not if it spin down. And this will read one single electron sensitive. And this phase here is a controlled knot operation with 1 layer of quantum error correction, and there's 45 steps and 28 qubits to do it with 1 layer. So it's hard to see. There's too much light in here. But that dance is, and I'll explain it. This is telling you how quantum error correction would be performed in a real system. We estimate that it would take 3 orders of quantum error correction, so the resources go up as a cube. But even in 1 level of error correction, it's quite formidable. And then we're getting to the end of the movie. It's hard for me to see. I wish it was brighter. So then what happens? Every movie should end with a climax. So the quantum computer takes on average 4 guesses to break a 2048-bit number. And here's one of the 4 guesses, and it cracked the code. And then everybody's happy, and they hand over another $100 million for research. Okay, and then I'm supposed to show the credits. Oh, so I'll go. Some people might even know some of the people here. So I'm required to show. That I'm not required to show. These were the... It was professional artist animators that did that. Then this was done with Austin Fowler, who was in Melbourne and then was at the University of Waterloo when this was done. These guys were all in Melbourne, Andrew Greentree, Lloyd Hollenberg, and Ashley Stevens at the Center for Quantum Computer Technology in Melbourne, and Bob Clark, who was the director of the center. He's now chief defense scientist for Australia, and Glenn McWright at the Laboratory of Physical Sciences, who gave good suggestions and handed over the money. And it was funded by U.S. Army and whatever, and Australian Research Council. Okay, so let's put that at the beginning. And now I want to explain. So I want to explain what's going on. So we'll watch the movie again, and you'll understand everything, I hope. Okay, that's the challenge. So we got 20 minutes. So again, you saw this. That was the phosphorus atom. So just like with the quantum dot, the extra electron is the carrier of quantum information. So the electron has a wave function, spatial degree of freedom, and the spin of the electron. And so, and then it's got a huge overlap with the rest of the silicon lattice, which is why you saw some sort of interference fringes. We didn't draw the fringes that well. It turns out that you have to make choices about what you're going to do nicely and what not. By the way, this movie is not available. Copyright's held by University of New South Wales, and I can't distribute it. I'm sorry to say. Okay. This is the phosphorus atom, and it's hard to see with all the light in here, but can you see it? It's hard to see. There's magnetic field lines coming down, and the magnetic field lines have the property that it raises the degeneracy of the electron spin. So the electron spin doesn't care which way it's spinning. It's the same energy in all directions. But if you put on a magnetic field and wait for milliseconds, then the electron will lose its energy to the system and relax to some spin. So remember, in quantum computing, you always want to start with zeros. You don't have to, but practically that's what you aim for. So the idea here is the initial sphere was just a uniform distribution over all spins, because there was no control of the spin state. But then by applying the DC magnetic field, it gives you a direction. So it's like on Earth. You know, if we talk about up and down, you take it for granted because there's a gravitational field. In this system, you put a magnetic field on, and it gives you a sense of up and down, and down is lower energy than up, so all the electrons will relax to that state at the South Pole, and that will be the zero. So that's what that phase is. And then over here, there's the block sphere. I've already explained that to you. It goes down to that state, which is actually the one. and the magnetic field. Yeah, I don't need to go into it. Okay, so that was the purpose. It prepares it all in the zero state. Now, there's mathematics here with these Hamiltonians. These sigmas are just Pauli operators, and it turns out, even though the electron spin is the quantum information carrier, the precession rate depends on the overlap of the electron wave function with the nucleus. So over here, you see a Hamiltonian, and the Hamiltonian has various terms. The BZ is just the magnetic field, constant magnetic field, or DC magnetic field in the Z direction. That splits the up and down energy. It's always on. So that splits the electron spin up and down differ by twice that. That's over here. And then there's the magnetic field, which also affects the nuclear spin. And here, there's coupling between the electron and nuclear spin. So the question was, how do we control a single qubit? And the answer, so it's actually fairly complicated, I think. And the answer is that the single electron spin is controlled by having a magnetic field that's always on. So these terms that you'd like to turn off, you can't. They're always on. And then there's that A gate. And the A gate is a local electric field. And here's a dot product between the electron spin qubit and the nuclear spin qubit. So even though none of the quantum computing involves a nuclear spin, there's that dot product is that strength is proportional to the probability of the electron being inside the nucleus. So when the electron's inside the nucleus, they interact. When it's not, they don't, roughly speaking. And then there's the AC magnetic field. And the AC magnetic field is global and just also controls precession. And so without going into that, the idea is when you saw these kinds of curves, and remember, we went to rotating frames, so the electron spin was precessing like that, stroboscopically, so we only do measurements when if you did nothing, the electron would always be in the zero state. So it goes around. And then we did something like a Hadamard and took it off. It was by controlling the local electric field, which affects the electron nuclear coupling. So that's the way the control is done in this scheme. Then, this just goes into the rotating frame approximation, which I don't think I need to go into. Yeah, okay. This is more technical stuff than we need to get into now. And then this is the effect. So the effect, these blue lines are the way that we artistically depicted the local electric field coming off the gate. And so what it did, it distorts the electron cloud. Here's the nucleus. The cloud overlap with the nucleus is controllable. But I told you there's a decoherence that becomes very obvious in the animation, that with the interference fringes, the overlap is very sensitive to where the fringe is. So that'll be an additional problem. As well, lattice vibrations would also be a problem. And then we have various Hamiltonians. So the whole movie is trying to be quantitatively accurate. And so the electron cloud distortion changes the electron-nuclear interaction, reduces it, and that's what changed the precession rate. And then there's a bunch of Hamiltonians that tell you how. And there, this is the pullback. So we kind of dived into the quantum computer and then pull back. This is the metal gate that does the A operation, the A gate. And the A gate, in fact, this is what metal looks like. Like we just used pictures from like nanotechnology pictures of metal. So that's what a metal looks like on a nanoscale. These are the electric field lines that come out of that metal strip. That distorts the electric field. And then this is the how it's going to process. It's going to come off. And this is the reference frame with all the other qubits that are processing that we have to keep track of. Okay, and then we go through various steps, this is just step one. You know, electron processes there. Step two, this is at the wrong place. So it takes a few steps. This kind of whipped around like that and then came back. No, this whipped around like that to here, and these ones went around to the top. Okay, so that was the A gate that controlled a single qubit. And the J gate, the idea is to be able to have the control between the two. So I mentioned in the Loss de Vicenzo scheme how these electrons bumped heads. And so here, the idea is the following, that the J gate controls distortion of the wave function at a different angle, and the electrons are still bumping heads, and when they bump heads, they have a mutual effect on each other's wave function. So that means that when this distorts, it distorts the overlap of the electron with the nucleus, but virtually bumping heads with this one causes an additional distortion, and that's what gives the two-qubit interaction. Okay, so this is controlling, making sure they bump heads. It was interesting to me. I thought when we were started making the movie, I thought these would be much closer together. But once we did the equations and looked at it, we found that, you know, if you do like a 1 over E contour of your wave functions, they're actually quite far apart. So it turns out that the interaction term is strong enough, even when it looks like they're, you know, like to me, if I think of exponential dependence of tunneling through a barrier, it looks very far away. But that's what it is. So, and then this is the part I mentioned here. It's probably hard for you to read, especially in the back, but the message here is that the single qubit operations are on the order of tens of nanoseconds, and the two qubit root-root swap is on the order of 100th of a nanosecond. So I'm wrong. It was goes from 100 to 10, so it's three orders of magnitude difference. So actually doing this in real life means that your electronics has to be able to operate alternatingly between three orders of magnitude of controls. So it's actually quite challenging to think about, but that's the idea. And whereas Loss de Vicenzo had a root swap, the root-root swap comes in because of the reference frame. So the reference frame comes in, so it actually puts an overhead on how the operation is done, which was kind of interesting for the few people here doing quantum reference frames. Okay, this part I left out of the... I kind of breezed over it quickly, and I don't want to spend a lot of time on it. I'll just tell you that if anybody knows DiVincenzo's criteria, there are five, but then there's an additional few that you can apply, and one of them is known as the flying qubit. And the flying qubit, an additional criterion, is the idea that if you do unitary gates, you need a very closed system. But if you prepare and measure, you need a very open system. And so most people, including me, think that circuit-based quantum computing without flying qubits won't work. And so it could be wrong. It's just, you know, kind of an intuitive way of thinking that could be incorrect. But the idea is that, you know, we kind of want one region that's closed and one region that's open and transport between them. And so this idea here, this is where the controlled knot operation takes place, and then you've got to get one of the qubits and read it out. And you don't want to read it out there. You transport it over to here and then read the state. So CTAP stands for coherent transport by adiabatic process. Anybody here has a hardcore quantum optics background, I don't think people do, but it comes from quantum optics known as stimulated rapid adiabatic passage. And so the idea is that the electron to go from there to there is going to, in between, there's a bunch of phosphoruses that are all without an extra electron. So phosphorus ions. And what you want to do is get your electron from here to here, but it's going to quantum tunnel through those. But if the electron hopped one to the next, it would then scatter and lose coherence. So the idea is it virtually tunnels across. So you make a lot of bridges and wells, but you detune the frequencies so that it really does one quantum tunneling through the whole thing, and it's just coherently assisted in between. And I said I don't want to go into it, but if anybody wants to understand that process better later, I'm happy to go into it. There's a lot of subtleties. So then the electron would get to that phosphorus, and then it's going to be read. And you want to read the spin. Is it spin up or spin down? That's the logical 0 and 1. And the way that it's read is your phosphorus here now holds that excess electron. You hope it's transported with the spin state intact. And then it's going to tunnel into a reservoir. So that's your environment. So it's going to lose energy and go in. But there's a barrier. And the barrier will only let it tunnel from there to there if the electron is spin up. If the electron is spin down, it can't get through. This is a single electron transistor, and these things really work. It gives a click if it detects an electron. So if the electron is spin up, it will relax into there. This will click. If the electron is spin down, it won't get through. This won't click. So that's the readout phase. And then once it gets to there, the movie doesn't show it, again, we have to make choices, then it has to be sent back to here, initialized to the spin down or spin up state, and so on. So the idea is that there's a preparation phase. All your qubits have to be recycled. If you don't recycle qubits, you get exponential overhead. So that's the idea. And once the electron relaxes into there, it looks like this. It's just distributed throughout the reservoir, and then it's got to be sent back again for recycling. And then this was the quantum error correction dance, which unfortunately is hard to see with this projector in the light. And so over here, this just kind of represents what goes on. There's that CTAP operation, which is going to send the electron down some chain, and then it's going to be, the SET is the single electron transistor relaxation, so an SET antenna is what goes click if an electron passes. But I'll skip over that. That's really getting to the measurement phase. Okay, so I think that gives you what you need to know, and then I'll play the movie again. I'll pause if I need to and explain, but this time you should have it should be clear what's going on. So again, the motivation, find the prime factors of the 2048-bit number. I said at the end it takes millions of years and only a year's worth of minutes on the planned phosphorus and silicon scheme. And then, and so again, here's the greater silicon chip. So one of the ideas is that a silicon-based quantum computer could be hybridized with a regular computer, dive into the chip, dive in again, and then here, so this I'll pause. So over here, you now know what these are. This is all your electronic control, but this is your quantum register. And so these are the phosphorus atoms, and it looks like one rail of phosphorus atoms, but it's actually four. So there's a, which we'll see again when we dive in, there's an outer rail for preparation and measurement, outer pair of rails, an inner pair of rails for unitaries. So the unitary gates are all single qubit or two qubit. Because we can have two qubit gates, we need to be able to send in electrons and get them back out. And so the inner two rails allow two qubit unitaries, and the outer two rails allow preparation and measurement. So each of these are four phosphoruses. In fact, there's many, many more phosphoruses that are used for transport, but the idea here is that the blue dots are the neutral phosphoruses. So a blue dot means the phosphorus is neutral and has a donor electron in a large orbital. And we just have a dark spot for a phosphorus without the excess electron. So most of the electrons have been sucked out of the system. Okay, so that's the outer rails. Now you got the phosphorus atom. There's the phosphorus nucleus. Here's the silicon structure. This is the Bloch sphere for the electron spin state. And that's the relaxation of the magnetic field. All the electrons are now in the logical zero state. And then there's a precession that takes place in a global magnetic field. And it precesses. Then mathematically, we transform to a rotating frame. And so in the rotating frame, the electron precession then becomes simple. It goes around a great sphere. But, of course, we want this, if we're doing identity operations, it should just stay where it is. So the flashes of light indicate that all operations have to be synchronized with when the reference frame spins are here. So there's a synchronization issue to do with reference frames. And then here we want to control that precession, so we do it by a local electric field that changes the overlap of the electron cloud with the nucleus, and that changes the precession direction, and that would be a Hadamard transformation. Except all the other qubits didn't go back to where they started. They went to here. So we have to do more complicated precession so it does a Hadamard when the reference frame goes back to the logical zero state or whatever. If we do a controlled dot operation, we do it by a sequence of 8 single qubit and 2 qubit operations. The single qubit operations are controlled by A gates. The 2 qubit operations control the tunnel-mediated collision rate through a J gate. There's 8 steps. It would take about 100 nanoseconds. There would actually be a correction phase we didn't show. And then that's a controlled knot operation with no error correction at all. That dance you'll see later is full quantum error correction. Now, what you saw, that controlled on operation, you'll see it again here. There's actually a pulse turn on here, then a pulse there. The controlled knot, that qubit, has tunneled to here in a way that's supposed to preserve the coherence of the spin. And then if it spin up, it will tunnel past a single electron transistor and into a reservoir. If it spin down, it won't do that. So that's the readout phase, and the SCT goes click. This is the quantum error correction, so controlled knot. And I actually want to explain a couple things here. Okay, so here there are four rails. Actually, I can't see it yet. I'm going to go another step. Oh, almost have it. Go. Oh, that's good. Oh, dang. Okay, well, that's close enough. You see, can you see here? There's a qubit out here. So, no, let me get the other picture again. Wish I had a better control on this. There. Okay. Remember I said there were four rails? So, over here, you see qubits along this rail. If it was darker in here, you could see it better. And qubits along this rail, and you see here and here. So there are four rails. These two rails are all subject to unitary transformation, single and two qubit. And these two rails are for preparation and readout. And the reason that, like blue dots, you don't see them move, they disappear and reappear, because they're quantum tunneling. So we're trying to represent the tunneling by disappearing and reappearing dots. And so this means that there's a neutral phosphorus. It tunnels. So it's going to tunnel across, and it'll tunnel through these dark phosphoruses that are actually ionic. And so that's what the dance is going to be. I wanted to explain to you. And for the controlled on operation, we have to have 28 qubits and 45 steps for first order quantum error correction. I'm going to see if anybody can get why there's 28 qubits. So anybody here study quantum error correction? You know this? Yeah? You know the Steen code? Okay, how many qubits in the Steen code? 7. Okay. So, anybody else that familiar? The Steen code for quantum error correction? 7 qubits. Okay. But we're going to put it into 14, and we're still using the Steen code here. So let's see if we know why there's 14. So there's 7 qubits in Steen code. What about the measurement? How's the measurement done in Steen code? With Ancilla, right? Because in quantum error correction, you do measurement, and you have to recycle the measurement qubits. Anybody else do this stuff? Anybody else know Steen code? CSS? Where's John? John Yard's not in here. Okay. So you'll learn more about coding this week. Okay. Remember I said you have to recycle everything? So in the Steen code, you have to have the Ancilla qubits and recycle them. Do you know how many in the Steen code? I don't want to know. 6. Okay. So there's 7 qubits for a Steen code, one level of quantum error correction, and 6 for Ancilla. That makes 13. But we're using 14. And the reason we need 14 is because of the reference frame. So it turns out we need 7 qubits for coding, 6 qubits for Ancilla for measurement, and the 7th for the reference frame. And then we have 14. We're doing a controlled knot operation, so we have 2 qubits. 2 times 14 is 28. So that's why we have 28 qubits. And when it goes through 45 steps, it's a lot of steps, but we have to keep doing these root-root swaps. But not just for the two-qubit interactions, but also the way measurement's done is by controlled unitaries. So it takes 45 steps to go through. If we went up to higher level encoding, then instead of 14, we'd have like 14 cubed or something like that. So, you know, 3 levels of quantum error correction, and it was just too hard to do. So if we showed the level of quantum error correction we need for one quantum error corrected two-qubit gate, it would have been way too complicated. This is already hard enough. So this is the dance that you see. Oh, and I want to show you the next beautiful thing. There we go. Beautiful. You see, all the qubits here have lined up in pairs. It's a controlled knot operation. Okay, so we only have one person who knows Steen code. Is that right? Oh, 2. Okay, so let me ask you this. There's 3 famous encodings. There's the 5-qubit encoding. That's minimal. There's the first one ever, which is Shor. That's 9 qubits. and there's the 7-qubit Steen code. Why do we use Steen? Transverse, that's right. Transverse coding. So what happens is if you do a Clifford operation, then in your code space, it still appears the same. So if you do a controlled NOT operation with Steen code, then when you encode into 7, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, you also get transverse gate. So it becomes a pairwise controlled NOT, or in this case, whatever operation you're doing, that's the Clifford operation that we're trying to do. So once in a while in this animation, you'll see them line up in